operative phrase that I would want you to pay attention to is a right to respectfully request that the following judges be appointed to the Supreme Court. I repeat, a right to respectfully request that the following judges be appointed to Supreme Court of Ghana. Now, this letter from the Honorable, no, I have two. You want it? Oh, okay. I thought it would be a waste of time, but Chair direct that I read the document as a whole, which I will do, don't worry. So I will now go over. I write to respectfully request that the following judges be appointed to the Supreme Court of Ghana. One, Her Ladyship Justice Angelina Mensah, Justice Eric Chebafor J. His Lordship Justice Edward Amakwasa J. Her Ladyship Justice Sarah Pamela C. E. Cranty J. Her Ladyship Justice Efia Sarewusewa Efia Asarebotwe Efia Asarebotwe J. Then goes on. Justice Asante's term of office at the ECOWAS Court ended on the 31st July 2022. He was requested to remain at post on account of the withdrawal of Mali, Guinea, and Burkina Faso from the community. His current tenure is expected to end in 2026 or earlier, where he is expected to return to Ghana's judiciary. Now, this letter was publicly construed to mean that the Chief Justice was interfering with the powers of the president as contained in the constitution and received a lot of criticism. One. Two, the general practice that we've known when it comes to nominations to the Supreme Court has been that nominations come from various stakeholders in the legal fraternity. And on the basis of that, the Judicial Council does deliberations on these nominations and makes a recommendation to the President for the final decision of appointment. Now, in the recent appointment of seven, of which you are included, there was a single letter that emanated from the presidency directly to the Judicial Council, which letter directly affected the appointment and urged upon the Judicial Council to advise. My Lord, with these two scenarios given you, I want to ask you, within the context of the provision in 1442, which you've already read, and at the risk of being repetitive, I would go over that other Supreme Court justices shall be appointed by the President, acting on the advice of Judicial Council, in consultation with the Council of State, and with the approval of Parliament. How do you place on the advice of the Judicial Council? Is it the case that they will nominate for final appointment as was contained in the decision of the Supreme Court in the matter of Ghana Bar Association against the Attorney General when my Lord Mafosau, my Lord Apau, and my Lord Puaman were eventually appointed out of the four recommendations made to the presidency and in a certain order. And the Ghana Bar Association took issue with the presidency that, look, Judicial Council made a certain recommendation in an order of merit. And it was Mensah Bonsu, Mafosau, Apau, and Puaman. But the president took from the bottom two. How do you reconcile all these scenarios within the context of upon the advice of the Judicial Council? What is the function of the Judicial Council in this whole process, in your view?
So from, thank you, my Lord, from all that you have said, what really is the question? The functions of the Judicial Council in appointment of judges, is that it? No, Minority Leader. Is that the question?
You talk about
the
case.
Yes.
So I can talk about it.
Very well. Proceed to answer.
Honorable Chair, I knew about the case because at that time I was the president for Association of Magistrates and Judges of Ghana. So I know much about that case. What happened in that case is that the president brought seven names to be considered. Then Judicial Council added two names. Then the bar brought two names. And the Judicial Council conducted interview. And at the end of the day, they concluded that their nominees had been number one and number two. And the one brought by the president, three and four, and the others have failed. Then the president said, once he has gotten Justice Yawapa and Puaman out of them, he will throw them because he has not nominated them. The law says he should nominate. So, Justice Amenuvo and Mr. Frank Beecham, they brought an action against the Attorney General. And the Supreme Court, the majority decision by Justice Atuguba.
I was part of the case. It yes. wasn't majority, it yes. was unanimous.
Unanimous. Yes. What Justice Atuguba said was that, leading the lead opinion of the court, what he said was that every nomination must be endorsed by the president or must stem from the president. So this one, once it was not made by the president, it does not bind the president. That was the Supreme Court decision, which binds everybody. Thank you.
My Lord, I do not want to have a disagreement with you on this, but maybe sometime we may have to refresh in our memory. I was involved in that case because our case was consolidated, because at the time I was counsel for a plaintiff who was challenging the appointment to the EC. So we had a consolidated case. I respectfully, and I do so in all modesty, the government of that had made a recommendation of all four to the president.
Honorable Minority Leader, sorry to interject. The rules are clear. When questions and asks and answer provided, you do not argue, you don't offer an opinion, and you don't address. So please, ask another question.
Chairman, let's make this exercise as interesting as possible. Let us help shape the public discourse in a very coherent manner. All that you said is not what I am doing. My Lord has stated a view on a judgment that, as a lawyer, I really was part of. If I am seeking to clarify, I've not gone out of the rules. Please, you must also, please, respectfully, pay attention to my line of discourse, so that you don't hurriedly rule me out of order or say I am saying something different. I am so making
ask your clarification.
Sure, question. That's exactly what I'm doing.
Yes, ask clarification question.
Honorable Bid, please. Bid, you've had your time. Bid, please, don't do that.
I'm entitled to ask a question.
The chair is directing affairs. Please. stay.
Honourable members, you are entitled to ask a question to clarify.
You don't have a better personal relationship with my Lord Denis Ejiofor than I. Stop it.
The comment.
He knows me.
The argument. The sharing of opinion is what the rule says we cannot do regarding questions.
One is entitled to provide clarity. It also helps the discourse. My Lord, like I said earlier, the government of that decision was to the effect that to the extent that the Judicial Council had made a recommendation of all four, it doesn't matter the order of merit. It doesn't matter the order of merit. The president could choose the four, whether from the bottom, in the middle, or whatever. That is it. And I remember the end phrase of my Lord Atuguba was that mutatis mutandis, the case is dismissed. And we all laughed loudly in court, and then we walked away and thanked the bench. Now, to the scenarios I've given, I want to know from you specifically, what is the opinion you have on the phrase, the president acting on the advice of the Judicial Council, the context of this phrase in the revision? What meaning do you give to this?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Honorable Chair, for Ghana, as I said, that is the decision that has been rendered by the Justice Atuguba. I remember your case, but because it was consolidation, each of them maintained their identity. So now if you read, you will still say that it is different from yours because it was consolidation. And in the judgment, you read them independently, the conclusion. Now, this is how Ghana has construed this. We have the same provision in Sierra Leone. But the Sierra Leone one, the same provision, word for word, they are saying that the Judicial Council, which has the Attorney General, may liaise with other stakeholders and come out with names to be considered by the President. That is for Sierra Leone. But Ghana, this is the interpretation that we have given, and it is binding on me. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you. Yes, you have the floor.
My Lord, I want us to deal with statutory construction and executive discretion. You had earlier on talked about enactments providing some penalties. Someone was asking you about social media and all, and the threat press freedom. And you made it clear that some of the enactments on communication law, the electronic communication makes provision for some penalties that criminalizes it. Although it's still seen in the context of free speech, but it has criminalized it. Now, this one, I'm relating it to the Minerals and Mining Act and our Immigration Act. Now, when laws provide both criminal penalties and deportation powers for the same conduct, which of them would take constitutional precedence? Can the executive choose administrative remedies over legislatively prescribed criminal sanctions in the case of a foreigner that we will not prosecute, but we are going to exercise administrative discretion of deportation?
Honorable Chair, I don't know the context, so I'll be at large. What I will say is that where the law prescribes that if the person is convicted,
then let me limit you to help. If let me give you the specifics so that you don't have to spend a whole period. Does that work with you? Very well. So, my Lord, on this issue of illegal mining, We have citizens of Ghana who are caught, arrested, and they face prosecution. Government announced that for foreigners, they will invoke their exemption. Want to know from you is that in view of the law criminalizing the action, the act conduct, can there be an administrative remedy over a legislatively prescribed criminal sanction? Can that take precedence over the criminal sanction provided for by the law merely because the person is a foreigner?
No, Honorable, but Honorable, one, the thing about criminal law is that the state exercises eminent power. Because the state may decide, even enter Nori Prosecutor, don't do this. So that power, even though it may not be palatable, it may not be acceptable, once the executive has the power to control criminal proceedings, it may do it.
My Lord, do you think from what you've just said, would you want to suggest to us that there are constitutional limits on prosecutorial discretion when statutory criminal penalties are mandatory rather than executive discretionary power is being exercised? Is that a suggestion?
Honorable Chair, what I'm saying is that the power to prosecute is vested in the Attorney General. Attorney General may decide to prosecute or not to prosecute. Somebody may be a thief. The person might have been seen holding something, but the Attorney General says, I will not prosecute you. You cannot compare Attorney General to prosecute. That is what I'm saying. But I'm not saying that whenever there is a conflict, that is how it should be resolved. If there is conflict in the law, that one, I am a legal interpreter. I can resolve it. Thank you.
Yes. So, my lord, the mainstay of my question, and I believe a lot of Ghanaians are concerned that we are caught in the act of illegal mining. Keep the frequency clear. Because I'm a citizen.
And what you've just been listing there is the vetting of Sir Dennis Ajay, one of the nominees to the Supreme Court, being questioned right now by the minority leader, Alexander Afenyo Markin. And there's a lot that we will be bringing you. For those of you who missed the first part of the day when the vetting of another Supreme Court judge was the basis for the haggling between the minority leader and the chair of the appointments committee, where the minority and majority leaders took on each other over the justification for nominating 7 judges to the Supreme Court. At the time, Chief Justice is suspended and being investigated for alleged judicial breaches. We'll have the details for you as Alexander Afenyo Markin accuses government of institutional capture and constitutional crisis.
An executive that suspends one Chief Justice while installing 7 new justices is not filling
vacancies. But also tonight, we will hear from wife of embattled former Finance Minister Ken Oforiatta following his successful 4-hour-long prostate cancer surgery in Minnesota, USA. We have the very latest for you. You want to stay with us for that. We'll return to Parliament. And so when this particular verdict wraps up, we'll get you reactions to what Justice Dennis Ajay has been saying to the Appointments Committee. But for now, though, former Finance Minister Ken Oforiatta is recovering from prostate cancer surgery he underwent last Friday at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, USA. In the last few hours, the wife of the embattled former finance minister, who is currently the subject of an Interpol red notice, has issued a statement providing details of the procedure. My colleague Kojo Brace joins me in the studio with more on this. Kojo, What do we know from this particular
statement? So we do know that the former finance minister has undergone the scheduled robotic assisted radical prostatectomy. This was to deal with what we understand is prostate cancer, and it was done at the Mayo Clinic, as you just said. Now, she says the procedure took 4+ hours, which is more than 4 hours to go about. Now, according to what we are learning, the doctors are pleased with how the procedure went and will now place him on a post-operative regime. We also do know that he is doing well, but the wife says this has been very difficult for him because the OSP chose that period just before his surgery to declare him on red alert. She says Kenneth is bearing up well and focused on doing whatever he can to restore to good health. But she concluded by saying that the family is truly grateful to the support and prayers of many people and pastors.
Brice, thank you very much. Thankfully, we can speak to Professor Mrs. Angela Ferriata, who's a wife of embattled former Finance Minister Kenneth Ferriata, and she joins us right now via Zoom. I'm grateful that you could join us, Professor Ferriata, here on Newsnight. How is Kenneth Ferriata tonight?
He's doing very well, thank you. He's a real trooper and has... And is just sort of going through the steps of recovery, which the doctors expected. And so we're very pleased that this is happening, that he's going through well.
You say this surgery lasted 4 hours. The doctors, what have they told you about his recovery?
4+ hours. We know this, that he has quite a bit of pain. We know that he has to walk gingerly, as it were. And we know that we have to make sure that his wounds don't get infected. So those are just sort of the things that one has to go through when one has surgery.
Have they told you how long they expect his recovery to last?
I think that they're expecting that, you know, he'll be much improved after a while when the wounds heal. Then there will be a period of about 3 months when there's observation going to happen. And hopefully after 3 months, the recovery will be complete. And that's if all goes well.
Office of the Special Prosecutors, one of his main grievances with Kenneth Ferriata was that initially in the early part of the year when he had wanted him, he had indicated that he was going to have a surgery earlier in the year. That didn't happen. Can you explain to us how come that earlier surgery was then shifted to last Friday? What happened there?
I'm afraid you have your facts wrong, sir. The message, the communication with the special prosecutor was that there would be a biopsy in March, which is a procedure to determine determine if there is cancer in the prostate. And that happened in March. And then after that, there were tests on the sample taken, and then it was clear that there was cancer in the prostate, and then the surgery was scheduled for June 13th.
I'm pretty sure you followed the OSP's latest press conference when initially, Ofuriata's lawyers wrote to him asking for more time, which reason he withdrew the earlier wanted notice. What was the reason for the request that be rescheduled?
I'm sorry, I'm not getting the
initially,
question.
The OSP declared him wanted. You remember that?
Was it in February he was
in February
the first time? Yes.
And you had requested that they take it down because you were ready to return in June after you had gone through that procedure. Remember that?
You know, this is a tough question for me to answer, because the very first time we gave the OSP, we had first told the OSP that we would be, we were in the US, we were doing investigations, and therefore we would not be available on the first date he gave us. We had told him that. But he wanted a date by which we should be there to see him. And so, knowing that we would have to do a biopsy, we gave him the possible dates after which Ken would have recovered from the biopsy and we would come. But we always knew that if the results of the biopsy were not good, then he would have to undergo surgery as quickly as possible. So that's what happened. We've got the results of the biopsy. We talked to the doctors about the next steps, and then we got in touch with the OSP. So that is what happened. It wasn't an attempt to keep moving it.
So I have here in front of me the initial letter from the Mayo Clinic dated February 7, 2025, which is titled To Whom It May Concern. And it says, "Hello, dear sir, madam." And it says, "Mr. Kenneth Ofori-Atta has been seen and evaluated in Mayo Clinic in Rochester. His medical condition necessitates that he will stay and follow up on his appointments and undergoing further testing and management, including possible surgical intervention in March of 2025.
Mm-hmm.
Did that surgery happen? And how come that surgery was then rescheduled to last Friday? That was my initial question.
Yes, that happened. That was the biopsy. The biopsy is a surgical procedure. And so that's what I just said to you or shared with you. So there was a surgical procedure called a biopsy in March, in which the reason was to get some samples, test, and know exactly what was happening. And then surgery was scheduled.
Now that we have clarity on that, back to the OSP point. OSP says that he agreed to pull down the wanted notice because of this, and that when this then was rescheduled, he wasn't told directly. What do you say to that? Because that's his point, that if he had been told and the medical report shared with him, the outcome may have been different.
You know, I don't really want to get into the legalities of it. I do know that he was told through first of all, our lawyers worked it out through the court system. So he received the document. And we do know also that they were willing to share with him all of that information. They didn't want to put it all out publicly because those were Ken's health records. And so they asked him if they could come to his office and share that information with them. So that's what I know about the matter. It was in our interest to let him know.
Fundamentally, the picture has been painted, and in fact, the OSP had said that he is convinced that Ofori-Atta simply does not want to come and face accountability. He's made the point that he is not incapacitated to come and answer the questions. In March, it was a biopsy. And on the face of the Mayo Clinic letter I read that mentioned surgical procedure, he says, but a biopsy should not incapacitate you. Is he right to conclude that that is a fair basis to say that he, Kenneth Freata, your husband, is simply running away from facing justice?
The Ken that we all know does not run away from accountability. We know that through the censure, he talked in the public about his work. We know that he has been to Shraj, talked about his work. This is not a Ken who runs away from accountability. So, I ask the public to remember when they've heard him speak, he has not shied away from facing up to issues. It's amazing that we've had to deal with cancer in the last year, that this is the process by which we have hopefully ensured that it doesn't spread. If I were to make the choice, I would make it again. I don't know any wife or any family that would send their loved one to respond to a special prosecutor when they're battling with cancer. So I'm sorry, but these are the things. This is what we have to face. We have to get him well. And even through this very stressful time, he has always said, let me respond to you by video. It's allowed. Let me do that for you so that I'm not the cause of you delaying your investigation. He said that. He's also said, okay, you can ask my lawyers the questions you want to ask me and we will respond. Whatever information we can give you, we will. So I just don't understand what's going on there.
A few circles we need to square here. In February, when the wanted notice was first issued for him, and you wrote for that to be pulled down, as I've gone over that again, you could not have possibly known at the time that he had cancer. So why didn't he just agree to come before the OSP at the time?
We were here in the States because of the cancer.
But the Mayo Clinic letter just read said at the time, you were now about to perform what the Mayo Clinic said, possible surgical intervention in March. You just explained that when they said that, it meant the biopsy. So you couldn't have known at the time, correct?
No, last year we knew that Ken possibly had cancer. So we came, we saw the urologist, we began the process. And they were quite clear that, you know, this was a slow-growing one. That's what they thought. And so we came back home quite happy. And then in December, the tests in Ghana revealed otherwise. And so we rushed back and began that process.
So the test in Ghana said otherwise, as in confirmed that he didn't have cancer or did?
Yes, the PSA levels were high.
So you had gone to the US to, of course, run the biopsy, which will put it beyond doubt.
Hang on. We came to the US last year. We realized that the PSA levels were going up last year in August. And then, you know, the clinic said, okay, we'll just sort of, we're going to watch this, come back in a few months. Well, in a few months, the PSA had gone quite high. And so we came back. We came back in January and we informed the chiefs of staff, the former chief of staff and the current chief of staff about it. And then we came and did the tests in January. And they're like, okay, this is growing faster than we thought. But we will do the biopsy in March because of the timing. We'll do it in March. And so that's when we got that letter from the Mayo Clinic to say, stay, do your biopsy in March.
Could he have come, take and answer the questions and gone back?
Would you, if you had cancer, would you leave it and go and meet an investigation when you're not 100% yourself? Do you understand the impact of cancer on a person's feelings, emotions, psychology?
As it is now, the Interpol Red Notice is still active. How is he dealing? How are you? How is the family, yourself and Faria? How are you dealing with that? Because there's a possibility now. We filed last week, the Deputy Attorney General confirmed that they've triggered the processes to formally ask for the USA to cooperate with us in extraditing him back to Ghana. How are you dealing with that? There's a possibility that any time, if that process goes through, he may be a subject of detention and possibly repatriation, extradition to Ghana.
Well, I don't know that any country would extradite someone who is not well. And so I don't know. I know that when he is well and at the appropriate time, we will come. But our lawyers are dealing with the notice. I myself, as the wife of a man who's not been well, I myself don't understand how a prosecutor would do a red alert or cause a red alert to be done over someone who's constantly told you where he is, constantly told you what he's dealing with. So that for me, that is something that I don't understand. And I would like to focus on how we are managing all of that, how he's coping, and how we can surround him with love and prayers and get him to feel, to get better.
I mean, about how he's feeling, how he's coping. Having a red notice issued for you, it's no child's play. How is he coping with that? The fact that the entire world, this has been reported on almost every international wire, the Bloombergs, the BBCs. How is he, considering also that he's just had surgery, how is he coping with that?
He's coping with it the same way we've always done through all of the tribulations, with God in the picture, the just faith and love surrounded by his family. It's just knowing that the Lord will do something with this. We don't know what, but we have faith. Because you're right, it's a difficult thing. It's a very difficult thing.
And the children?
They've got good heads on their shoulders and they've got faith as well. So it's a lot of thinking, prayer, and just knowing that there will be a light at the end of the tunnel.
When you use that figurative language, what does that look like for you in reality, light at the end of the tunnel?
It's a good question. I'm kind of living day by day. making sure that my husband, you know, gets over this, the physical illness and the emotional trauma. So that's what I'm dealing with. And I think for me, that's the first light at the end of the tunnel. The second light at the end of the tunnel is, of course, it's justice. It has to be justice. And right now, I'm just living day to day, making sure that he's better. But when I look at, I want to see the light at the tunnel. I also want to thank the people who are standing with us in prayer, the people who love us, the people we love, and prominent pastors praying with us, calling us. Warishayeng in Krung, as we say in Tri, giving us hope.
Will Ken Oforiatta return to Ghana to answer the questions that the OSP wants to ask him, and when?
As soon as we know when, we promise to let you know.
But can you also say
he is ready
today that when he gets well, he will certainly return to Ghana and answer the questions.
The questions he can answer in a week or two. You send him the questions to his lawyers, he can answer. You set up a video a meeting in a week or two, he will be able to answer. He will not do anything to interfere or prolong the investigation. And Ghana is home. I don't think there is any other home but Ghana. I know Ghana is home. So why are we holding back on the investigation? Why will he not give the video?
The special prosecutor says they have a warrant to arrest him.
You know, I'm not going to speak to the special prosecutor's issues. I just want people to know that Ken's been through the surgery. He is doing well. And when he is able to and his doctors give him the go-ahead, of course, at the appropriate time, he will come. But why are we keeping the investigation not going on? Why?
You just made the point that at the appropriate time, he will come. Is that a firm yes, that when he gets better, he will come and answer the questions physically himself here in Ghana?
Ghana is home. Ghana is home.
In your previous statement, you use words like vendetta. You believe the OSP has won against your husband?
I don't want to talk about that. I think all I want to say is there's so much I don't understand about this process. And I want to thank people for standing with us. And Ghana, I just want to leave you with the understanding that Ghana is home. And when their time is right, he can come.
Does he accept, though, that this is simply facing accountability for the time that he was a finance minister? Does he actually accept that? That this is the OSP trying to do his job to hold him accountable?
No, I don't agree with you on that, because the man has been held accountable even during the time he was in government. He went on a censure that didn't go through, but he answered these questions in parliament, many of them already in parliament. And you know that, you saw that. You saw that at Shraj as well. Shraj has gone through all of those. And so he has never not been accountable when asked. Okay. So I have to say that we have a great resource in the lawyers, and these questions you can ask the lawyers. But for now, I just want to thank you for this space.
I'm grateful that you spent time with us. And that there is the wife of Ken Ofori-Atta, Professor Mrs. Angela Ofori-Atta, who is with the Ken Ofori-Atta in the U.S. As you've heard, he is recovering now after the surgery on Friday. Make of that what you will. And Georgia Fay is here with business. Hello, George.
Hi, Evans. And coming up in business, more of some major oil marketing companies have actually started reducing the prices of petroleum products at the pumps. And also the Institute of Economic Affairs urges government to suspend processes aimed at extending the licenses of Jubilee operator Talu to 2036. The Business News on Newsnight is brought to you by MTN Business. Welcome to the new world of business. Condone books and stationery, Synthes tanks, and Pepsodent, herbal, and charcoal.
It's your day off, and you